WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
With me is Maya Angelou, who came to Philadelphia today to speak at the Philadelphia Inquirer's Book and Author Luncheon. Maya Angelou lives an extraordinary life, which is chronicled in her series of autobiographical books, which begins with I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings. Her fourth autobiographical volume has just been published under the title The Heart of a Woman. It begins in about 1957, when she is about 30, a single parent to her son Guy, who was born when she was 17 and unmarried. She described herself at the time as a club singer with more persistence than talent. After living in a beatnik community in the West Coast, she moved to New York, where she joined the Harlem Writers Guild, became inspired by the work of Martin Luther King, and eventually became the Northern Coordinator for SCLIC, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. Her struggles as a single parent were temporarily abated by her marriage to an African freedom fighter with whom she traveled around the world. People who you may know who figure into this autobiography include Billie Holiday, Max Roach, Abby Lincoln, Martin Luther King, and Malcolm X. Maya Angelou has since written for television, served on the Commission of International Women's Year, where she was appointed by President Carter. Her volumes of poems include Just Give Me a Cool Drink of Water Before I Die, and Oh Pray My Wings Are Gonna Fit Me Well, and I think the most recent is And Still I Rise. Welcome to Fresh Air, Maya Angelou. I very much enjoyed your new book. Let me quote something from the opening page. As you say that I had to trust life since I was young enough to believe that life loved the person who dared to live it. You attribute that to the young Maya Angelou. Would you live or think any differently now?
I believe that now. I think I'm still young. I think that that is one of the characteristics of youth, and not having to do with chronological age, but the youth in the spirit. And as long as one keeps a youthful spirit, one is youthful. I believe today that life loves the liver of it. I think that life wants to be taken by the lapels and told, I'm with you, kid.
You've really done a lot of impulsive actions during your life, the part anyways that's chronicled in your new book. Is there anything that if you had thought about it longer, you wouldn't have done?
Probably almost everything, if I had thought about it longer. But the actions might appear to be impulsive, but I trust something inside myself. When I find myself in a new situation and I have to trust, I don't have time to think and ration out my next move, I trust what the Southern black people used to call my Toby, which was a name for any lucky thing a person had, a coin or a rabbit's foot or a horse's shoe. That was called a Toby. Well, it was believed that people had Tobies which were non-visible, non-material. So I have to trust that thing within me, which is my Toby, to get me out of the situation into a better condition. And so after I run my brain across the barrier and see that I really don't have time to think it out, then I trust my Toby and move on it, and I'm prepared to live with the, you know, whatever happens.
Billie Holiday visited your house in, I guess it was the late 1950s? Yeah, it was. Well, it had to be. It was shortly before she died. And you said that. She thought that you were very square.
Yes.
You were a little concerned that she might be bringing drugs with her, and because of your standing in the community, in part, that wasn't going to be a
well. It wasn't
very
my
safe
standing
thing.
In the community. I had no standing in the community, none at all.
Well, I thought that might be part of the problem.
Yes, that was. But. No, it was just that I didn't want drugs in my house. She called me a square, and she was absolutely right. But I didn't know how I would be able to say to Billie Holiday, who was my, you know, larger than the pyramids to me, how could I actually say you can't shoot up or sniff up or whatever she might have wanted to do in my house without so offending her that she would curse me out, and how would I deal with that? And yet I knew that I wouldn't allow her to do that in my house because I was raising a son. That was the most important thing. I was raising my son, and I simply wouldn't have that. But I became quite nervous in anticipation or dread of her coming because I didn't know how I was going to handle it. Fortunately for me, she never did it. She never did it. If she did, I never saw it. She stayed with me for 5 or 6 days. And all day long, from 8 o'clock in the morning, 9 o'clock in the morning, until I'd go to my job, I was singing in a nightclub, and I'd drop her off at her hotel before I'd go to my job. Now, if she used anything, it was in the bathroom, and I never saw it.
As much as you admired her and as strong as you felt about her singing, she was pretty arrogant and sometimes pretty rude to you. What was your strategy for dealing with your hero who was being kind of nasty in the moment?
Well, I think I've waited. You know that West Africans have a phrase which is obviously in great use among Black Americans and even more use among South Africans. But the phrase itself isn't used here. But it is exercise patience. Exercise patience. And obviously we have done that, and I was doing that. And I still find myself, when a person starts out to be rude or starts to do something I don't agree with, quite often I will wait and see, is this an impulsive move on the person's part? If I say something, will he or she not get my message that this is not the thing to do? I have less patience as I've become older, rather than the other way around. But at that time, I thought, well, if I just don't say anything, maybe she won't continue with this rather brutal way of talking. And quite often, she really would stop. She asked me for some food, and I hadn't planned to cook for her. And she just asked, what are we going to have for lunch? And having a chicken, which, of course, one has always a raw chicken in the fridge. So I said, I would do a chicken and rice and an Arkansas gravy. And she said, all right, chicken is all right, but cook that sucker. Fry that sucker. And she just, So I told her that I might not be a great singer, but I knew how to cook. I mean, not to get it mixed up. And she apologized. She said, I didn't mean to hurt your feelings. I just can't stand blood on the bone of a chicken. So each time I would speak back, I wouldn't, my rejoinders were never as harsh as her statement. But she understood that sort of knocking me off would be like taking a double-barrel shotgun to kill a flea, you know. But even though I was a flea, maybe, compared to her, I still had to stand up.
I really found myself envying your son during that sequence because she sang for him at night when he'd go to bed, and I thought how wonderful that must be. But you said he probably would have preferred to play Scrabble.
And word games and all that.
Could you tell us the story of when she was singing him Strange Fruit and how he reacted to what she said? And
well, you know, she used to curse a lot. She cursed in the most innovative ways. But she stopped cursing when my son would come around. She would simply stop, which was unheard of for her, since every other word was profanity, or when she wanted it. But, and then sometimes she would still sort of surprise herself with some vulgarity while he was around. And I never use profanity. And she would look at him and say, excuse me, baby, that's just another bad habit I got. But the last night, she sang him Strange Fruit. And he really was not, he was 12. and her voice was gone. And he couldn't appreciate, I mean, I appreciated what was happening. But she began, Southern trees bear a strange fruit, blood on the leaves and blood at the root. And Guy interrupted and said, Miss Holliday, but how can there be blood at the root? And I made my face look like a fist. I said, shut up. Don't say a word. Just shut up. And he wore these great horn-rimmed glasses. He was called the professor at 12, you know, huge glasses. She continued, pastoral scenes of a gallant south, bulging eyes and a twist and mouth. And Guy said, Miss Holliday, I don't understand pastoral scenes. And she turned. And she just she just erupted, using every word, every profanity. And yet she said, it means when them crackers is doing this to them, then she just, and when they take a little boy like you and they just rip his genitals out, you know, and, oh. And my son, who had never been spoken to that way, looked at her and then looked at me with such anger. And he said, good night. Good night, I'm going to bed. And he turned and walked out. Well, I went to him. I apologized for the way Miss Holliday spoke. He accepted the apology coldly and said, good night, Mother. I was supposed to take her to her hotel, and I told her how rude she was. And she asked me, but did I lie? Did I lie? So I was trying to make the point to her that the end does not justify the means, but it didn't get over.
He really held that against you for a while, I guess.
For quite a long time. It's about 2 weeks before I wormed my way back into his good graces.
She did another crazy thing to you when she followed you to the club?
Yep. I was singing. I had introduced her, and it was the policy in the place never to introduce, because it was Hollywood, and never introduce any celebrity, because you might overlook a celebrity, and then, you know, you'd have hard feelings and so. But with Miss Holliday, I said, oh, no. So I introduced her, and the people stood and applauded. And I started to sing, and I was singing an old blues, which was, baby, please don't go. Baby, please don't go. Baby, please don't go back to New Orleans. They feed you rice and beans, the worst you ever seen. Baby, please don't go. And I was really, and there was just the bass playing, drums and bass. And suddenly she screamed, stop that B. Stop her. She sounded just like my GD mama. Oh, Lord. I felt so awful. And she got up from the table and went into the toilet. And I just stopped the orchestra. I mean, there was a big orchestra, but I stopped the musicians. And I said, I'll be back. And I followed her in the toilet. And I was really going to let her have it. Really. I mean, I didn't use profanity, not because I didn't know it. I chose not to use it. And my temper was never, minuscule. And I wasn't afraid of anything. So I was really, she was going to meet her match. And I ran in the toilet, and a little woman just ran out of the toilet as I got there. And I said, let me tell you one thing. I mean, Billie Holiday. And she said, oh, baby, don't worry about it. You can't help how you sound. All black women sound alike. All colored women sound alike, unless they're trying to sound white. She said, you can't help sounding like my mama. So she forgave me. I was coming in to exact from her an apology. And then she said, did you see that little white woman that ran out of here? I said, yes. She said, I come in here to go to the toilet, and she's sitting on the toilet. And I opened the door, and she said, close that door. And I said, B, if you wanted it closed, you should have closed it your GD self. So I said, Billy. I said, you know, that woman might have been an old fan of yours. She said, girl, you see how when you called my name, all them crackers stood up. And I said, I saw the people stand up, Billy. She said, you see how they applaud? I said, yes. She asked me, you know why? I said, because they honor you. She said, BS. She said, they just stood up so that they could see a black woman who'd been in jail for dope.
She gave you some advice on your career.
Yeah. She gave me advice on a lot of things. She told me that you couldn't ever get so high, somebody wouldn't like to bring you down. She gave me a lot of advice.
But she told you, yeah, go ahead.
The main thing she did for me really had nothing to do with what she said to me. But when I almost lost Guy, when those 2 weeks, when he was as cold as a fish to me, and we enjoyed each other's company, we laughed a lot together, I realized, he told me, he said, when I grow up, I'm not going to let anybody, no matter how famous she is, curse out my children. And I realized that, not just for her, but or any famous person, but raising a black child in this country, I had to always be between him or her, whatever the child, and a force which would deny him the room to breathe in. I had to always be that. It helped me to grow much more protective without being suffocating. From that day, all his life is until he became a man, I stood between him and murderous forces, whether they do what Jules Pfeiffer called the little murders or the large murder. I would never. They'd have to do me first. But it was through Billie Holiday that I learned it.
She had said to you that you'd be famous, but probably not for your singing. And it wasn't too long after, I guess, that you gave up singing.
That's true. I didn't realize it until this minute when you said that. Really?
What made you decide to give it up?
Well, I could sing reasonably well. And sometimes I could really smoke. But I never loved singing. I never loved it. And in order to become great, I don't mean great for the world to see, but great to stretch to all the breadth and width and height one can aspire to reach, one has to love the thing, love it. And I never loved singing. I sang to make my living. And I love to sing in church. Oh, I can sing in church all for the whole service. But I never loved standing in front of an audience and singing. I love to write. One has to be ready to sacrifice almost all body comforts for the thing, whatever it is.
When you moved to New York and joined the Harlem Writers Guild,
yes.
They were really tough on you and on all the other writers.
Yes.
Now, I found that really interesting because it seemed to me that they wanted to really give the kind of forceful criticism that writers need. And with that came implicit support, I think.
That's true.
But the criticism was there. It wasn't
That's right.
It wasn't blind support or, or just unconditional support.
And the criticism was so severe, the challenge so unrelenting, that writers or people who said they wanted to write but were not willing to developed the kind of concentration to be found usually in people just about to be executed in the next 15 minutes, were weeded out. You really had to be committed to writing, to be in the Harlem Writers Guild in the late 50s and the 60s. You just had to be committed to having such control of the language alone that you could ball up a figuratively, ball up maybe three nouns and four adjectives and a few verbs and connectives in your hand and throw them against a wall and make them bounce like rubber. You just had to have such control. And I stayed with them. I believed it. I agreed. And I fell in love. I've always loved words, and I'd been writing for a long time. But I hadn't really tried to understand what writing well was all about. It is said, I think Hawthorne said, easy reading is damned hard writing, and vice versa. So to write, try to write so that a reader is 30 pages in a book before the knowledge, awareness of reading comes upon the reader. That's writing.
Speaking with Maya Angelou, if you're just joining us, and she's just completed the fourth volume of her autobiography, and it's called The Heart of a Woman. It was about that time also in New York that you really started becoming very interested in Martin Luther King and the movement that he was leading. How did exposure to that change your life? I mean, I know it led to job opportunities and change your life in that way, but how did it change the way you saw yourself and saw the work that was cut out in front of you?
Well, I think that seeing Dr. King was like seeing the light at the end of a tunnel. I mean, not having been aware that one was in a tunnel. He was so bright and hot. And the hope he extended to us all, to black and white, and to all Americans, the hope he extended was almost reachable. It was like a magic time. And I thought that singing was much too frivolous. I wanted to do something more directly involved with helping to change the world. I was so proud that he existed. I was so proud of myself for being black at a time when Martin Luther King existed. It was magic. I can't describe it anymore, except in my book I have tried to do so. And I might be able to understand it more if I wrote it.
You organized the Cabaret for Freedom with
yes.
Godfrey Cambridge,
yes.
Proceeds to benefit the movement,
right.
Benefit SCLIC. I guess there were a lot of black performers who really didn't feel like they could do their acts in a good place, and let alone doing it with the proceeds going to a cause that they believed in. Is that something that you think could work well today? Is the equivalent of the Cabaret for Freedom happening anywhere?
I don't think that the equivalent is happening. I think it could work. It's one of the rare few things, I think, which can work today. My belief is that out of every era comes leadership. And the strategies come out of the era themselves. And, you know, only from the time can a strategy which will work for that time be successful. However, a kind of review is a part of the human entertainment cycle, and we've always had those sort of things. I think of everything from West African storytelling, North African storytelling, the days of the amphitheaters in Rome, Greece and Asia and Europe. I mean, there have always been a kind of what the television media now calls magazine shows. And so the review would be a wonderful idea today. It's one of the few things, I think, that would work.
What kind of acts did people do for the Cabaret for Freedom?
Well, there were comedians. There was J. Flash Riley, who was one of the leads in a Broadway show. I'm sorry, the name is gone, but it will come. Godfrey Cambridge, of course. A woman named Leontine Watts, a singer. Orson Bean. There were skits, and it was an exciting thing. People, not everything directly spoke to, quote, the movement, unquote, but there was nothing which was a put down of the movement. There was nothing that was in contrariness to the movement. And people had a great time. It was really entertaining. And the proceeds, except for the monies which were paid, which was paid to the actors and to the performers, the rest of the monies went to the Southern Christian Leadership Conference.
At that time when you were not only participating in, but organizing actions, when there was an action that you and Abby Lincoln and a few other women organized to be held in the UN after Lumumba was killed. And you had gotten some advice from your friend who had become your husband, who was an African freedom fighter.
Yes.
And part of the advice was to make sure when you do an action like that, that the people, the grassroots community, is behind you in it and aware of the fact that you're doing it. Can you tell us how you use that, and if you thought that is good advice?
Yes, it's excellent advice. It wasn't so that they would necessarily be with us, because we didn't really expect them to come down to United Nations, but so that they would know what we were doing and why we were doing it. So we wanted a demonstration at United Nations to say that black people protested the murder of Patrice Lumumba. So we went on 125th and 7th Avenue. We spoke in front of Mr. Michaud's bookstore and let the people know that we were going down. Maybe if we got done in, at least the people in Harlem or somebody would say, well, they were killed because they were trying to do something for us. At least we would just be there and sort of be knocked out, you know, and nobody would know why. Well, of course, it seemed about a tenth of Harlem came down. There were thousands of people down at United Nations. We'd expected at most 50. There were thousands of people. We were thrown. There was Rosa Guy, Abby Lincoln, and I. In particular, we three. We had an organization we had founded called CAWA, Cultural Association of Women of African Heritage. It's quite a mouthful, but we had hoped to be the cultural arm of any organization meant to make the country better than it was. And so we'd gotten our few members and some of their men, some of their husbands or lovers or friends or whatever, and a few friends who weren't attached. And we had expected 50. And when we got out of the taxis and saw those thousands of people milling about, we were really undone. We rose to the occasion because what choice did we have? But the truth is we were shaking in our boots. It was quite a flamboyant demonstration and successful. Obviously, Mr. Lumumba could not be brought back. So that was, but I mean, successful in that there was a great many people knew that Black Americans were not casual or uncaring about the murder of Patrice Lumumba as a result of that. So that Africans began after that to say that Black Americans care about Africa. And that was the first demonstration of its sort to say that.
I think. There was some other advice you got that you applied in the same action, and it was that if you ever really need help, particularly in a spot like that, to take someone who's really streetwise, maybe even a hoodlum, ask for his assistance as opposed to a middle-class Black person.
Yes. Well, that's true.
And maybe you could describe for us the situation that you did it and how it worked out, and I'll tell you my reaction afterwards.
A friend, a young man, Carlos Moore, who was a Cuban, had been very instrumental in getting some of the people into the United Nations before we sort of stood up and were counted literally and figuratively. And when we came out, I heard that he told me, let's go to the Belgian embassy, Belgian consulate. We went, and when I arrived, I was told that Carlos had been in there for, and it was on the 11th floor, I believe, that he had been in there for a half hour, and no one knew what was happening to him. Well, I thought somebody has to go in. And rather than ask anybody to do something, I'd rather do it, especially if it's dangerous or very hard work. I'd rather do it myself. But I needed someone to go with me, and I thought of what my husband told me. He said, if you're ever in danger, never go to a middle class or bougie. Now, he's South African. Xhosa, he is. Pan-African Congress. He said, go to a tsotsi, which was the name in Xhosa for a thug. He said, he will know that he has nothing to lose. And if he agrees to go with you, he will go all the way. So I looked around on the street for the person who looked most like, you know, that. There was a man who had scars, I mean, running everywhere except in his eyes, just, he'd been brutalized, and he had a mean look on his face. And I said, excuse me, brother, but my name is Maya, and little Carlos is in this building, and I want to go in, and I need somebody to go with me. Will you go? He said, sure, let's go. He didn't wonder what would happen to him. We went in. The place was teeming with police. There were police outside. There were riot squads and everything, all white. And we went in, and the policeman with lots of badges and brass asked where we were going. And I had seen on the directory that there was a book company on the 10th floor. So I said, we're going to that book company. And the policeman asked this tsotsi, and he said, I'm with her. I'm going as far as she goes, all the way. He was wonderful to me because we got locked out in the fire escape, you know, the inner fire escape, and the doors were locked, and I panicked. And he told me, Sister Maya, you don't have anything to worry about. He said, they have to walk over my dead body to get to you. You just stay right here. And, I mean, he just took over. And, you know, it showed me a number of things. I learned a number of things from that. One, that it is wiser, late to learn it, but it is wiser to be a bit more prepared if you're going to risk your life. And never to risk anybody else's life. I was very embarrassed that I had, by my silliness, risk that man's life. I also learned that there is a level of courage which is so automatic that trumpets do not go off. Rhetoric is not, you know, doesn't come into the voice that greatest speech that I shall do this. The man just said, you have nothing to worry about. They'll have to walk over my dead body to get to you. And when we got out into the street, and I said, oh, I want to thank you and apologize and I want to tell my husband how good you were. And he said, just tell him there was a black man who was ready to go the distance with you, that's all. And he just sort of merged back into the crowd.
I found that a really amazing story.
Yeah.
And I asked myself if I would ever do anything like that, though I haven't ever been in quite that position anyways. But there was a moment in it when you're in the stairway and the doors are locked on either end and you can't really get out and you're expecting that people will open the door and maybe shoot you.
That's right.
And then the person who you had asked to accompany you turned toward you, and I mean your writing was very excited at this point, and I was prepared for something to happen. And when he turned to you, I said to myself, "Oh, I hope he doesn't attack her.
Yeah.
Is he going to rape her? Is she now going to become his victim?" And I got really scared for you in that moment. And obviously, I had no reason to, because everything was under control. Mm-hmm. But is that the kind of thing that you would ever think about, or if you were in that position again, or do you think that...
Oh, no, because the life was at stake, both his life and mine.
Right, so that would have been a really stupid thing to...
I wouldn't have ever thought that, no. I wouldn't have been surprised at the moment if he had turned and said, how could you have, you know, gotten me involved in something as stupid and dangerous as this.
Right.
I mean, you know, if he'd put me down, that wouldn't have surprised me, because when I came to myself after the panic subsided, I put my own self down. So that wouldn't have surprised me. But what did surprise me was the ease with which he showed his generosity and his courage.
It's a great story.
Mm.
You went to talk to Malcolm X afterwards to see what advice he'd have on what to do next, now that all these people had been mobilized. What did you think of his politics, which were considerably different from Martin Luther King's politics?
Yes. Well, I had really expected him to say, well, great, we'll... What we were concerned about, of course, was that the black people had shown, by coming in such numbers, that they were really furious in Harlem. And so we thought, since neither Abby, Rosa Guy, nor I, or any of the other women in our group, knew what to do with this sort of large amount of anger and mobilization, we thought we would talk to Malcolm, and he would say, okay, we'll take them and tell them what to do. You know, sort of take over the responsibility. And he said, no. He said, we are Muslims. Muslims do not send black women and black men and black children down to face the guns and the dogs. We do not do that. And we were so disappointed. But he said, I'll tell you what's going to happen. Tomorrow, every black leader of your middle class leader, every member of the middle class leadership will put you down. They will say that you are communist, you do not represent the mood in the black society, black communities. And he said, but we will not do so. I will not join that brigade. The next day, it was absolutely true. We were called radicals who really did not understand what was at stake, all sorts of ridiculous things. And Malcolm said that What that action, that demonstration proved, was that white Americans had better understand it was time now for ballots or bullets, and that was a very real demonstration that came out of the heart of Black America. So we were, you know, partly pacified, but he was a staunch Muslim at the time, and really his politics were intertwined with his religion, and they simply could not be separated
at that time. I guess he was familiar with being denied by other leaders and being called too radical and atypical of the mood of the people.
Right.
Most of the period of time that you write about in the book, you are a single parent, and you're constantly having to decide between the things you want to do, whether that's, you know, moving from the West Coast to the East Coast, or going without a job to wait for a better job, or just going out at night
just
and staying late
out
at a party.
Yeah.
You always have to weigh that between what it means to you and what it's going to mean for your son. Did you have any, like, guiding principles to lead you through that period in weighing all those decisions?
Well, some, yes. I decided that no man would sleep in my house. No man to whom I wasn't married would sleep in my house. And I had as healthy an appetite as the next person. So I devised all sorts of ways of getting out. And then Guy was 12, or say 13. He was too old to have a babysitter. So I learned to lie quite a lot. I would go out and stay and visit with a gentleman friend and come home at 5 o'clock in the morning. Somehow, get in the house, and Guy would awaken about 6. I'd get in the house and take a bath and put on my gown and robe. And he would come out of his bedroom, and I'd be making breakfast, and he'd say, "Gee, Mom, I don't know how you can get up so early. I mean, gee, Mom, you really are so good." And I'd make breakfast and sit there propped somehow with my hand under my chin until he would go off to school. I would be so grateful to see the door slam so I could let's go to bed. But that was one of the principles in my life with him. I wanted his respect. And I wanted him to know that a woman is deserving of respect as a man is deserving of respect. So that when I did have a man to come into the house, and I mean, by this time, I wasn't putting a great deal over on him, you know, he's right. He had to appreciate what I had done, whether he knew I was, you know, fibbing or not. And he knew that if a man came into the house, that I was extremely serious about the man. And he had to act accordingly. That was one of them. I tried to tell the truth and to live it. I tried very hard to make him love truth. Love it. The real thing. Guiding principles.
Well, I've imagined sometimes what it would be like to have grown up with a parent or parents who were performers or who were in very active political or artistic circles, and you were very active in both, and to be moving a lot. And what a life like that would be like. Do you think that it was good for him in the long run? And, you know, did he emerge with an incredible political consciousness?
Yes.
And artistic gifts?
Yes. He has certainly political consciousness, but he has more and other than that. He is his own man-self stuff. He's a wonderful human being. Kind. He belongs to himself. When he was about 18, he explained to me that I had done something which really displeased him. And he said, "Mother, I don't know if you thought about this, so I better tell you that this action was really very bad. If you did it again, if you do it again, it will tell me that you intend to do it, and I will sever relationships with you, from you." He's his own man self. He's very serious, good sense of humor. There I had the choice of leaving him with others or taking him with me. And that seemed to me to be no choice. He might have had a more stable life. I mean, from outer, it would have been more stable. He would have gone to the same school, lived in the same house. But I was what he had. I gave him love and humor. So I became the stability. Wherever we were, that therein resided stability. Sometimes I made a lot of money singing, and I could take a tutor along. And he got, and I'd take a suite or an apartment hotel, and, you know, we lived posh. Sometimes I'd have 3 weeks of singing and 5 weeks off and 3 more weeks in the same town. And I couldn't stay in those posh hotels. So many times I stayed in hotels which had one bedroom, and I would string the sheet across the room, and he would sleep in the bed and I would sleep on the sofa. That was life, but at least we read together and we laughed, and He's healthy. He has a wry sense of humor. And it was the best thing that I could do for myself as well as for him. It wasn't just for him. It gave me, he became my rudder, too.
Speaking with Maya Angelou, if you're just joining us, you married for a while, an African freedom fighter who was the person giving you the advice that we referred to a little earlier. And you traveled with him to Europe and to Africa and met a lot of other freedom fighters and a lot of other wives of freedom fighters. The impression that I got reading that was that the women were kind of outside of a lot of the political decision-making. I sensed some resentment about that, though maybe I misread that.
Well, that first group I met in London, for the most part, were. But then the group of women I met when I lived in Egypt were, in many cases, women who themselves had escaped South Africa, Southwest Africa, Angola, Uganda. At that time, was still Kenya was still dependent or still a colony. But Southern Africa, from Basutu and Botswana land. There were a number of women who themselves escaped the repressions and walked from Southern Africa to Malawi, or walked 3,000 miles or 2,500 miles to freedom, or to what was away from that oppression, and themselves became politically active and involved in the freeing of their countries. So that first group I met were women who had, for the most part, who were simply wives of freedom fighters.
No, okay, I understand the distinction now. What, since you've spent a lot of time working on African issues and on American issues, is your time now divided, either for your political thinking or for your activist thinking, in terms of issues of immediate import to Africa and ones to America?
Well, I'm going to leave for Ghana on the 1st of December to to work out the practicals for a plan I have, which will begin to operate September 82. I've taken a chair at Wake Forest University in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. I'll take 20 students to Africa, 10 black, 10 white, all Southern. My course is called African Culture and Its Impact on the West. I'll give a mini course in April. So when I go over in a couple of weeks, it's to work out where I'm going to house the students, where they were board, and that's in, under which professors they'll be able to study. I suspect, I believe, I hope that those 20 students I take in 82, and I'll take 20 in 83 and 20 in 84, that those students will never be the same. Southerners tend to be conservative, not just politically. So of the 20, maybe 5 will relocate in the north or the east or the west. But 15 will stay there and go on to become principals of schools, elementary school teachers, doctors, chancellors of university, lawyers, mothers, husbands, wives, fathers. And they will be changed. And I hope thereby, in that ripple on after the rock has dropped in the pond, that effect, thereby to make some impact on the political and social face of my country.
Sounds like a really interesting way of doing it. I want to thank you so very much
for talking to us. Thank you very much, Terry.
Thoroughly enjoyed meeting you.
Thank you.
Maya Angelou has been my guest, and she's completed the fourth volume of her autobiography, and this one's called The Heart of a Woman. She's published a number of volumes of poems as well as the other parts of her autobiography.